Welcome back, everybody, to The Time Is Now. I'm your host this week, Carl Sweeney. Very pleased to be on this podcast for the first time. And today we're talking about Season 1's Weeds. And very delighted, very pleased to be joined on this podcast by Uber Millennium fan, Millennium Uber fan, Paige Schechter. How's it going, Paige?
Good. Thanks, Carl.
Yeah, good to talk to you again. I mean, we've podcasted elsewhere on a couple of different podcasts, actually. But it's nice to reunite for this.
Yes, we're multifaceted.
We are. We're ambidextrous or whatever the word is. Yeah. Yeah, before we get into Weeds, we've got this episode to discuss. But as it's my first appearance on this podcast, we're going to turn the tables just for a second, aren't we, Paige?
We are.
And you're going to ask me the Millennium Group's 5 initiation questions.
Yes.
So yeah, hit me with them.
Here you go. Okay. These are toughies. When did you first discover Millennium?
Well, I sort of discovered Millennium right at the beginning. I remember the hype around it in 1996. To give context, I would have been 10 years old at that time. So I remember my parents recording the pilot episode on VHS, and I got to watch it, but I mean, I can remember sitting down to watch the pilot episode. I remember being kind of enthralled by it, but I guess it must just have been too dark for me at that time. I didn't really want to stick with it, so I didn't see any after that until, I guess it must have been reruns a few years later, and there were sort of season 2 episodes I saw. Eventually, I would have seen the whole series on DVD, and I've rewatched it a couple of times, actually, all the way through since. So, yeah, kind of there at the beginning, but not sort of paying attention properly, as it were. So
I think that's probably best considering you were 10. Maybe later on you get more of an appreciation and you're able to handle some of the darker themes in it.
Yeah, I think so, because I think at that time I just would have been attracted by, I imagine all the marketing was like from Chris Carter, creator of the X-Files kind of thing. I was an X-Files fan at that point, but the X-Files was much more palatable, even though that series, I'm sure people know who are listening, gets very dark at times, but it wasn't like that all the time, especially once you got a few seasons in. So yeah, I think what you're saying is right. I was probably at a better age when I came back to the series later on. Yeah, I think so.
Right. Okay. Question 2, what is your favorite episode?
Okay, well, I'm going to choose the final episode of the second season, which is called The Time Is Now. Yeah, I really like that two-parter that closes off the second season. I sort of think of them as a spiritual end of Millennium, even though season 3's got some stuff I really like, but it's a bit rocky there at the beginning of the next season. But I really like the experimental stuff in that episode, you know, the Laramine's kind of montage thing, and just the kind of powerfulness of the ending in the grip of this apocalyptic plague event that can't be stopped. And that's an episode that whenever I do rewatch it, it stands up really well. It never fails to generate this kind of emotion. And yeah, is it the best overall episode? I don't know. There's some great stuff in the whole series, you know, in each season, but I'm drawn to that one for some reason. I feel like a lot of other people would go for The Curse of Frank Black or Lamentation or something, so I'm going to choose The Time Is Now. But
I kind of think that we should sometimes make a distinction between what we consider the best episode, but what is your favorite episode is the one, you know, you take most to your heart. And I can see that that one is correct for you. So I like that answer.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. What is your favorite season?
Yeah, this is a good question, isn't it? I think it's very, like, revealing. A revealing question to ask of a Millennium viewer, isn't it?
It is.
The series changes so much season to season. I have to say the second season. I'm thinking of the season as a whole here, the kind of shape of it and so on. I think the second season's got my favourite individual installments. Things like The Time Is Now, but like I mentioned, The Curse of Frank Black would be one. Midnight of the Century I really like, and some others. It has the fewest duds, in my opinion. I think both the first and the third season do suffer a bit from kind of forgettable or uninspiring installments. I think season 2's got maybe a couple, but not as many. I mean, I'm not actually completely sold on all the stuff in season 2. Some of them, I really like the direction the mythology takes by the time you get to things like The Fourth Horseman, but some of the earlier stuff I'm not as fond of. Things like, it's called The Hand of St. Sebastian, isn't it, is one of them.
Right.
So yeah, I'm not one of those people who sings the praise of season 2 entirely. I think each season's got its little flaws and things, but it's my favourite. Yeah, so that makes me a Morgan and Wong booster, I think, doesn't it? How did you answer this question, Paige, just out of interest, just so I know, you know, who I'm dealing with? You know?
Well, I've done two Millennium podcasts so far with two different people, so there were the five questions twice. And the first time I said season one because, and we're going to get into this in a little bit.
Yep.
It's very, it reminds you of what's going on in your own community. And so you can get into it easily that way. Season two has more of a nebulous nature, you know, about apocalypses and everything. But season one is what you can see and touch and feel. And so I got that as Chris Carter's, you know, intention for his series. But then there's season two has these amazing episodes, all of which you mentioned besides mentioning Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense.
Of course, the Baron August stuff. Yeah,
yeah. Another of my favorite episodes of all time television. So initially I said season one. I'm a big advocate of season one, but really it is season two has those powerhouses going for it.
Yeah, and like to be fair, some of my absolute favorite stuff is in season one. Like I love the pilot, I love Dead Letters and Lamentation and Powers, Principalities, Thrones and Dominions. I think it's maybe some of the less memorable installments that drag it down a little for me. Well, I mean, we may well talk a little bit more about this subject as we proceed.
That's probably true. Do you like 5226666? I love that one.
I was just about to mention that one, but I forgot the number. But yeah, actually, all the stuff Glenn Morgan and James Wong wrote in season one, and then obviously they go on to be the head honchos behind season two. So yeah, I guess I really appreciate their involvement in the series, is what I'm saying.
Right. Okay. So next question: who is your favorite character of Millennium?
Frank Black. I mean, I hate to be so predictable, but and I feel like everybody's going to say Frank Black, but Lance Henriksen was just so good. I mean, you don't see you don't see that many lead performances on the television series that are so committed and, you know, jaw-droppingly intense as Henriksen is as Frank Black. And I think if you sort of take him away, the whole thing collapses in on itself, you know. And Millennium always had this thing. I mean, there are some good supporting characters, don't get me wrong. I mean, I love Peter Watts, for example, but and again, we'll probably talk about this in conjunction with Weeds, but the series seemed to struggle a bit with some of the non-Frank Black characters at times. And he's always the kind of the fulcrum, isn't he? The rudder that keeps things pointing straight. And that's how I feel anyway.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, and final question. What is your favorite moment from Millennium?
Well, it's a bit of a horrific one. I'm going to go back to The Time Is Now. And the final moment, really, of Frank and Jordan Black. Frank's hair has turned white, isn't it, because of the shock and the world is ending and the music kicks in, you know, in the year 2525 and the episode ends and just chilling stuff, really. And I guess it's the visceralness of the reaction. It's the kind of thing people say, oh, the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, but it is actually true whenever I see that, you know. Just it's kind of indelible, I think. It's kind of etched onto my into my memory.
You're right.
That's the one I'm going to go for. Yeah, I mean, I wish I could have maybe actually the second place would probably be we see Frank Black in like a Hawaiian shirt or something, don't we, in Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense. That's my kind of more positive counterpoint to that.
Okay, that works.
All right, so am I initiated? Am I in the group?
You are in the group.
Excellent. All right, well, now that I'm a fully paid up Millennium Group member, I guess we should talk a little bit more about Weeds. So, Weeds, which aired in January 1997, I mean, over 22 years ago now, at the time of recording, which is just astonishing to think about. An episode written by Frank Spotnitz, I believe this is Spotnitz's first script for Millennium. Of course, people familiar with Chris Carter's work on The X-Files will also most likely be familiar with Spotnitz's contributions to that series too. This episode, Weeds, was directed by Michael Pattinson, and this is the episode in which Frank investigates a series of abductions in a small, designed neighborhood. The abductor is forcing his victims to pay for the sins of their fathers. Right, so Weeds, what do we think, Paige? How good is this episode, and what would you give it out of 10?
What would I give it out of 10? This is tough to say. I looked at the IMDb ranking, which is 7.6, kind of in the middle of the pack for Millennium episodes. I'd say it's about a 5 or a 6. There are the moments I really like about it, and there are moments where it kind of struggles to get where it's going. But from like the beginning, I'd say I'm invested in it right away.
I'm in agreement with you, I think. I think I was between the two myself. I was between a 5 and a 6. It's perfectly competent as an episode, without being, I don't know, anything more than that, it seems to me. You know, I don't think there's much here that necessarily stands out. There are some cool ideas, some cool scenes, but I don't know if it coheres into like a fascinating whole. It's satisfactory, I think. And it's quite funny that before we started recording, I mean, it's been a little while since I've seen season one. And we're recording this before the podcast actually launches, you know. And when the podcast launches, I'll probably be watching along week to week. But I was trying to remember which one Weeds was, and I thought it involved a kind of a killer who goes into show houses. That's Wide Open, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So I thought, and I'm glad I double-checked before we came to record, that that's what we were in for. But it turned out to be this episode instead. And does that point to it being a bit unmemorable, or some of these episodes being a bit samey, or what? I don't know.
I think they had, around this time, there's a trilogy of Wide Open, Weeds, and I'm blanking on the other name now. The one that comes in between Wide Open and Weeds.
Hang on, let's have a look. We'll get the list.
Now. Okay, it's sort of about life in a community like that.
Yeah, so the one prior to this was The Wild and the Innocent. Is that the one you...
Yes.
Okay.
And so they're all kind of going the same direction, and maybe they said, well, let's sort of go this way with it, let's go this way with it. They had 3 ideas for it, and they used all of them. But there is kind of, like you just said, sort of a sameness to them.
Yeah, which is a problem when they don't stand out in their own right, I think. And maybe we should talk, you know, this kind of thing about season one, which I'm glad they kind of moved away from stuff like this a little bit. Because my memory of season one is that there's some great stuff early in the season. So the pilot's great. I really like Dead Letters. You know, the ones I mentioned, 522, 666, Blood Relatives, I really like. But elsewhere, you start to wonder if the series is going to be able to maintain this for a long time, doing this week to week. You know, this thing where it's a killer of the week. They've got their own little quirk or whatever. How long is this sustainable for? And I guess it starts to change around like Force Majeure, doesn't it? Or something like that. Where they kind of broaden the palette or something. And I'm glad they did, because I think they would have run into trouble if they got stuck in a rut or something. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I do know what you mean. And it is good. They wind up completely swinging different ways with the different seasons. Yeah. But they do find a way to get it done. And Frank Black, like you said, when you were explaining why he was your favorite character, is in the middle of it, and he's the crux, and things can move around him. So there is sort of a malleability to it. It's very, what they wind up doing is very strong swings. But he is a malleable character in that you can put him into these different scenarios and he still works.
Yeah, I guess I think I seem to remember Glenn Morgan comparing that to, are you familiar with Alan Partridge, the British sitcom character at all?
Just in passing, knowing the name.
Yeah, well, it's kind of where the show changes dramatically around him, kind of thing. But, you know, he's always the same. So, you know, he's not got as much gravitas as Frank Black.
Oh, okay.
So.
Yes. I think gravitas might be Frank Black's middle name.
I think it might be. And on that note, perhaps we should take a closer look at Weeds and pick up on some of the other points to do with this episode. What do you make? Well, we get a teaser, don't we? Which sets up, you know, it's this kind of idyllic community and so on, because we see the kids playing baseball, don't we? Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's immediately contrasted with like the voyeurism, the slow-mo and the music that's playing and so on. And yeah, we get a 16-year-old's birthday party.
Can I make a reference here, cut in to the 16-year-old birthday party? My nephew just turned 16. So to watch this episode where this kid turns 16 and he, you know, he's not interested in being around adults and he loves his present, but he's never going to show that on his face to them. He's just going to be like, oh, that's cool, you know. So it
So it was authentic.
It really brings home Chris Carter's vision to me in the first season that these are terrors we are familiar with, you know, and big fears we have for the people in our lives. So right away, I was totally into it.
Now, it's interesting you say that you're totally into it, because the note I've made is like solid without being mind blowing, about the teaser. And the aspect of it I did appreciate, that twist at the end where the victim we see is not Josh, it's a different victim. Yes. Than we anticipated.
Yep.
So I liked that, but otherwise I was kind of like, this seemed a bit kind of by the numbers, but I think you are right that it seems genuine in terms of the way it portrays the teenager and stuff like that. I think that's definitely fair, but overall you think this is a good teaser, yeah?
Well, I don't think it's a great teaser, except like you said, the end is righteous. That is solid. It's just that I really can read into what's going on because it's going on in life. And so it mirrors the path of what's going on in life. Now, when we go on to season two, and like, these are experiences you can never fathom, but this I understand very, very well.
Yeah, good stuff. And then so we get, you know, the credits roll and stuff. And that's when I noticed that this was a Frank Spotnitz episode.
It's so funny. I have a Spotnitz note later on. This is when I know it's a Spotnitz episode.
Oh, go on then. So when did that click for you then? Because, I mean, Spotnitz, I think I'm a big fan of his, you know, principally for his contributions to The X-Files. I don't think he contributed quite as many scripts for Millennium.
I think there were five. Did he do five? I think I wrote that somewhere.
Yeah, five in total. Weeds being the first. Sacrament. Teotwaki, I don't know how you pronounce that. It's, you know, Teotwaki from season three, Antipass, and 7 and 1.
Right.
So he's not really, you know, so season two, he's not kind of on the spot kind of thing. So I suppose none of those episodes, from what I can recall, would be listed among the best of the entire series, would they? But yeah, good to see him on the scene writing for Millennium, isn't it?
It definitely is. He brings this solid quality, like when you were talking about, it's a solid episode. It's not something that's going to make us jump up and down and get into our top 10 list for the overall series, but it's watchable and holds your interest, and it's definitely Spotnitz. It's got Spotnitz running all through it.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out those episodes I listed, I think that, you know, some of them co-written with Chris Carter, for example, like 7 and 1. Solid definitely is the buzzword here, I think. And we get the scene, don't we, with Frank and the sheriff. You know, we get the sense everybody's rattled. This is supposed to be a very safe place. They've got 24-hour security and all this. So it's like kind of like we get this idea in the episode, don't we, of like the evil within that comes up, which is it's definitely a scary idea. I don't know if they really exploited it as much as they could, but I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, well, it's kind of a de facto scene where Frank goes somewhere and, you know, someone doesn't understand why Millennium was called in, and he has to explain who he is and what he does. And so the fact that it's a gated community makes it really interesting, because the killer is in there somewhere, you know, unless he's doing diaper service or something. I don't know.
All right. So, and they sort of talk about, I don't know, they think they've created a safe haven and stuff like this.
They do a lot of safe haven talk in this episode.
They do.
Safe haven comes up a lot.
Yeah. So what about this thing? So we get Frank's gift or his insight or whatever, where we see the flashes. I think he sees the cattle prod, doesn't he? That comes up later. What do you make of Frank's gift? Because that's always something like kind of a topic of discussion amongst fans, isn't it? So what's the exact nature of it? It seems to change season to season, like the show, doesn't it? Exactly what the gift represents.
I had this brought up in reference to the graveside sequence where we're not quite there yet, but I think what Frank Black is in the first season has this incredible insight into people. He's not predicting the future. He's not contacting spirits or something. He's just really good at his job. He's scarily good. He's probably too good at his job for his own good. But I think it's him, you know, he sees something and go, oh, cattle prod. So that, you know, he's seeing it in his head. It's not anything supernatural about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. Certainly at this stage of the series, and it's just a representation of his intuition, I think, is the intention, isn't it? I wonder if it becomes a bit of a story cheat sometimes, where, you know, it's a bit of a shorthand, but it's a very quick way of moving things on. I don't know. I've just on my notes, I've got the word blood written and underlined, and there's a scene, isn't there, where we see the boy hung up and everything.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did it seem to you like there's a couple of elements in this episode, like the cattle prod, like this thing that's going on with the blood, that they seem a bit extraneous or something? They're just added to be different or something, but they don't...
To be shocking.
To be shocking, but they don't really become central. Is that how it kind of felt to you?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely agree with that. I mean, when we later find out who the killer is, why was he forced to drink somebody else's blood? I don't really understand. I can maybe understand the cattle prod as that's how he's subduing them, although, you know, where a guy from a gated community came up with cattle prod, I don't know.
Yeah, it didn't seem to really build up to anything or pay off these elements, sadly. Anyhow, I mean, there's that scene, isn't there, with a community meeting, which I liked, you know, where they discuss curfews and things like this. And it ends with Frank addressing the meeting. And yeah, I thought this was an effective scene. I think one of the more effective scenes in the episode, to be honest. Would you kind of agree?
I think it's because Karen Connival's in it.
Yeah, credited as woman.
Woman, so. Yes. Well, because she speaks up, and when Karen Connival speaks, everybody listens.
Yeah, I guess probably not as memorable as some of her roles on The X-Files, to be fair. But no, it's always good to see members of like the kind of 10-13... stock company, as it were, isn't it?
And she's in so good, you know, it immediately sort of raises it a peg.
Yeah, I just wish they'd given her more to do, to be honest.
I don't know if I should make a reference to who we later find out is the killer here.
Yeah,
but,
go for it.
I specifically went back to look at this episode because I totally forgot who the killer was when I was doing...
Yep.
prep for the podcast, so I went back to watch that scene again, and there is one reaction shot from him when Frank is talking about the make of the vehicle, and other people in the scene have more reaction shots, so it's not like we could have kind of figured it out at this point. It really isn't there. I mean, it really isn't there for us to find out. He has these little tiny reactions, and even seeing it again afterward, I'm like, no, I can't really tell that it's him.
Yeah, well, I guess this raises the point, doesn't it, that, like, Millennium didn't really do whodunits very often. So it's actually, that's one of the interesting facets of this episode, isn't it, but it's structured as kind of a mystery.
Right.
And there are different suspects that were kind of led towards and stuff like this, and... I don't know if this is a very good whodunit, is the problem, I think.
Well, I have two... I have two schools of thought on this. On the one hand, I think that's Frank Spotnitz's point, that it is somebody nondescript. But the fact that we really don't see this guy, and he doesn't, you know, we're given these other characters, the coach and maybe the priest, because the boys would have, you know, said in confession what happened to him. I don't really understand why Ed Petey winds up as the killer. How did he find out this information that he knows about all these boys' fathers? And so in that sense, I don't really understand why he is the killer. And it seems sort of irrelevant. But on the other hand, I think, or on the other hand, I now have three hands. It seems like Frank just said, I don't have anybody left. Somebody's got to be the killer. Okay, the guy who arranged the association meeting.
Yeah, and I think that maybe in one sense, it's welcome that they mixed it up. They did a whodunit, because we've talked already about the similarity with some of these episodes. So I guess that's a point of difference, is what I'm saying, that maybe that does differentiate it somewhat. Mm-hmm. So that's good, I think. Let me raise a point of contention, perhaps. So, like, Lance Henriksen in this episode, we talked, I mean, I've already said how I love Frank Black and everything, and he's always reliably intense and so on. But with that said, is he a little tiny bit subdued in this one? Is he? I don't want to say phoning it in, because I don't think that's fair. I think he's committed and everything, but... You know, he gives these bravado performances elsewhere in the series. I guess he just doesn't have that much really to do here, but this is kind of what Frank Black, you know, this is kind of Frank Black by the numbers or something. But am I being unfair, Paige? Am I being harsh on Mr. Henriksen?
I think it's kind of set up that way. Sort of Frank Spotnitz knew what he was going to get from Lance Henriksen at this point and sort of scripted it that way. The bit I really like is during this town meeting where Frank is basically lying. You know, he's saying things like the guy doesn't want anything and he's insane and he's trying to prod this killer the way the killer is using the cattle prod. But that's very un-Frank Black. You know, he's pretty straightforward with what he usually says. And so that was kind of a different take that we don't usually see.
Yeah, so, you know, there's all sorts of stuff. There's a little motorbike chase and so on. Stuff about the number 331. What about this overall, though, this broader theme of, like, the sins of the father element and the domestic drama that goes on through the episode? I mean, I thought that actually was not bad. I thought that was quite an interesting tack to take, you know, that all these fathers were guilty of something or other, and that the killer somehow knew about this. I thought that was maybe more interesting, or I thought that element was well handled. You know, we said stuff like the cattle prods are just kind of perfunctory or whatever, but that thematic point I thought was quite well done.
Yeah, I sort of appreciate how these people's lives are falling apart, but many of the fathers still seem sort of sanctimonious and they have sins that are going to be revisited within the course of the episode. And it's sort of strange to see some of the ones who are louder about it, like the Birkenbuehl guy, who eventually kills himself. He's being so nasty at this town meeting, but he winds up being one of the biggest offenders. And that's sort of a different way, because that's how people act. I mean, this is how people act in the real world. They speak up, they sometimes speak out of turn, and then it comes back on them. And that really sort of hits home for me.
Now, I'll tell you, Paige, somebody we've got to discuss here is... We meet Cheryl Andrews, don't we? Played by CCH Pounder.
Yes.
What do you make of her? I mean, we see her a few other times, don't we, in the series?
Yeah, this is her second of five episodes over the course of the whole run of the show. She's in all three seasons. She, of course, we know her, the X-Files fans know her from her fabulous Emmy-nominated performance in Dwayne Barry. She gives a nice little... She takes the show somewhere else that he can't go with his wife, Catherine. Like, Frank thought maybe what he said at the meeting had adverse effect on the killer, and she's the one who says to him,
yeah,
no, you just messed up the killer's pattern. You didn't provoke him to do anything. So she's the voice of reason. She's something that Catherine can't give Frank. So I really appreciate her presence in this episode, although later it just gets out of hand later.
Yeah, well, that's for another day. But there's maybe another point here, isn't there? And this has probably come up on some of the other podcasts and things, but some of these early episodes, the Millennium Group members seem a bit like indeterminate. Like, so Cheryl Andrews is interesting because CCH Pounder is interesting, but it's a while before somebody like Peter Watts develops into the character he becomes, and there are other people we meet maybe once or twice who then disappear. And the show seemed to struggle a little bit, didn't it? It sort of it takes until the second season, really, before it develops that, doesn't it?
I think, yeah, they do flesh it out better in the second season. Maybe obviously, Morgan and Wong figured it out. But the actors also seem to relish it more in the second season.
I mean, you mentioned there that, like, Cheryl Andrews brings something that Catherine Black doesn't necessarily. And one of the things I thought was really interesting here is it's like over 20 minutes, isn't it, before we see the yellow house?
Yes.
And before Catherine appears. And she doesn't really get very much to do, does she? She's just kind of a sounding board in this episode, it seems. Frank starts to talk a little bit about an old case and stuff. But this is one of my issues with season one of Millennium, that in theory it's a show with two leads, isn't it? It's with Henriksen and Megan Gallagher. But they really don't use her particularly well very often, it seems like to me. What's your take on it?
I don't really think of it as a two lead show. I kind of think of it as a one lead show, and they do struggle to find places for her. But in the episodes where they do find places for her, where she is able to fit in, she fits in really well. It's just in ones like this, you know, she's just the wife, you know, she's the wife at home. He's come home and talking about his rough day, and she's wonderful. You know, you see the connection. It's a great chemistry. It works, but for the character, there's just nothing here. I mean, that the nosy neighbor has more of a character in this one than Catherine does.
Yeah, well, that's interesting in itself, isn't it? Because what's his name? Jack, isn't it? And
yeah.
We only see him like a handful of times.
Right.
And I don't know, I've always thought that character, maybe he was played a bit too broad or something. I don't quite know. But for whatever reason, they stop using him, don't they? And I guess, you know, we've got this thing set up in the pilot where there's the Polaroid killer or whatever.
Right.
And it's not the same killer here or anything, but you get the same kind of thing where Frank gets this delivery off Jack. And yeah, what do you think of Jack? Do you think he's in a kind of an agreeable presence? You like seeing him pop up in Millennium?
No, I think you're right. I think he's a bit one note, but he makes me laugh. And because it's, again, recognizing things I see in the real world, you know, about a neighbor that just is, or a person you know at work who is too much in your business. And you recognize that, and that's true, but you don't want too much of that. And so I'm glad they use him sort of sparingly. But it is funny that he's like their delivery man or something. Like, that's wrong. It. Do you have your houses numbered incorrectly? What's going on?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just looking down at my notes page, and I think that, you know, there are scenes, I've got things written down like, you know, gun, chase, and like I'm struggling to remember exactly what happened. I think it just goes back to the broader point of, like, you know, this episode did hold my attention while I was watching it, and I was making notes and everything, but some of the details are already blurred. You know, I remember there's a scene where Tom runs over the kid and so on.
Yes.
But this kind of midsection of the episode, I don't know, is there anything that really stood out for you?
I liked the swim team coach, because on the face of it, he looks like the best possible suspect for doing this, for what's going on in the community. His 8-year-old son was killed. But he brought something to it where you immediately knew it wasn't that guy, and if it turned out to be that guy, it would have been disappointing.
Yeah, so kind of a nice little bit of casting with him. I mean, I think the scene where Josh is returned alive, I thought that was a good scene. But I've written down, I think it must have been a quote, but, you know, making these kids drink blood doesn't make sense either. I think it's said in the episode at one point. And yeah, it's kind of what we said, that, like, that doesn't make sense when you get to the end of the episode either. It's kind of all seems a bit contrived. One element I really did like, I don't know about you, but like seeing Frank use his email, just all that stuff, like pleasingly like retro, I thought. You know, when he has that phone call with Cheryl. I think that Cheryl almost could become like an exposition machine here, but she gets these kind of a couple of little moments. Doesn't she talk about drinking whiskey or something?
Yeah.
And, you know, just give her a little bit of life. You know, she isn't just information. Although she could be that, I think, in the hands of a lesser performer or something, you know?
I think you're right. I think it could have been much less interesting if it wasn't somebody like CCH Pounder who just has this aura about her that sort of, and it fits the Millennium mold, which is why I wish she was in the series more.
In terms of memorable moments in this episode, I guess the whole thing with the blood in the football sticks in the mind, doesn't it? That's about it, though. That's my kind of visual I sort of see when I close my eyes and I think of weeds.
There's the guy, I like how they take the guy out in handcuffs, and then the killer is, no, that's not enough. You know, this man basically has to kill himself.
I mean, what I noticed, I think, was I was watching the episode, and I just kind of looked at the timer kind of thing on the DVD, and I noticed there was like 4 minutes left, and it still felt like the episode hadn't really built to much of a dramatic conclusion, you know. Eventually we do get this finale, don't we, in the swimming pool or whatever. But even that, I don't know if it really gets your pulse racing in a way. And you could say that's good because it's not sensationalizing things. But I don't know. I think some of the other episodes that are around this point of the series have better tension, have more effective dramatic kind of reveals and things like that. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think basically what I was saying before about how this killer kit slash kidnapper wasn't really involved in the majority of our story, it lessens the impact of the denouement at the end because there's no investment in him.
Yeah, it's like, oh yeah, him. But yeah. It doesn't pack his punch. And I think that you sort of said, didn't you, this might be Spotness's intention with the killer, that, oh, he looks the same as everybody else, but it just comes across as a bit low-key in a way that probably wasn't intended, you know, just a little bit underpowered. I don't know if it's the character as written, I don't know if it's the performance, you know?
Yeah, I no. Yeah, no.
How could this happen here is what's kind of said right at the end of the episode, isn't it? And the problem is that I'm not sure. I mean, the episode introduces all these ideas of like community and things. I'm just not sure it builds upon them well enough, you know, to where you get to the end of the 42 minutes or the 45 minutes and you feel like they've really asked that question. Yeah, I got to the final credits and I thought it was fine, but I was a tiny bit disappointed to be. And I guess, you know, we've said 5 or 6 out of 10. I guess that kind of summarizes why, but you know what I mean? That kind of a feeling of slight emptiness when the episode ended.
I think how could this happen here is almost a funny line considering what we've found out about who all these people are during, you know, there's affairs, there's people killing people, people doing this to each other, doing that. And how could this happen? How could this not happen here is how that line should have come out.
You sort of see this theme elsewhere, don't you? I mean, this thing about suburbs where there's a dark underbelly or whatever, you know, it isn't that novel at this point in time, I don't think. You mean something like David Lynch's Blue Velvet or something would be a very dramatic example of it, but you know what I mean, you see this in other TV shows that sort of pose the same question,
right?
It doesn't feel like Millennium was kind of breaking new ground here, I don't think.
No, I think it's the Spotnitz starter kit for Millennium.
Do you think the episode is overall, is it kind of a bit sensationalist? Because I think that's always the problem with like a serial killer show, isn't it? It's like, how much is it actually wallowing in this misery, you know? Because we get quite long scenes of, you know, suspenseful scenes and so on in this one. Does it kind of cross the line into being a bit overly sensationalist?
I don't think it crosses the line. Like we previously said, I don't understand the feeding of the blood, and then Cheryl Andrews gets hit with the cattle prod, and that seemed like a bit much, and you know, she's a bit smarter than to what ultimately happens to her. Luckily she's okay in this episode. It really seemed like, okay, let's wrap it up now. First, Cheryl's going to get hit with a cattle prod. So we haven't used our cattle prod budget up in this episode yet. So,
yeah, I'm going to agree with you. I don't think this episode is overly sensationalist because I think that would make it sound more interesting than it actually is, to be honest.
It's giving it more credit than it deserves.
Exactly right. Yeah, anything else you wanted to point out about Weeds, Paige, I guess, before we wrap up for this week?
No, I think we covered it all.
I think we covered the main points, you know, and I think it's indicative of what we said. I mean, someone else will be here next week talking about Loin Like a Hunting Flame. But then once you get to Force Majeure, The Thin White Line, the series takes a new tack and, in my opinion, gets a bit more interesting. But I guess the mid-season blues kind of is what we're sort of hitting here, isn't it?
Yeah, it happens to everybody.
All right, Paige. Well, that's us for today. In the meantime, where can people find you on the internet?
I think I'm found most of the time at sibling_cinema on Twitter with my sister. We have the X-Files Rewatch. We do 10-word movie reviews and 10-word TV reviews. And we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest. And other than that, I can be found where everybody else is in the Millennium Facebook group.
Yeah, cool. Have you written about Millennium on the blog, or is it going to come, or is your sister not interested, or what?
That remains to be seen, because we're just about up to the first feature film, so we have time for that discussion. But I hope that we get into the Millennium after finishing the X-Files.
Yeah, Millennium can be a tough sell on people, can't it? You know, but it seems like the people who really like it really like
love
it.
Love it. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, anyway, I can be found, you know, like Paige says, in the Millennium Facebook group that we've got set up. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at CKJ Sweeney. I'll be back hopefully later in season one, as you will, Paige, I think, hopefully.
Yes.
Until next time, listeners, always remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting The X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.